New research gives unprecedented insight into the frozen corners of our world. Scientists say there's less water and ice in the globe's glaciers than they thought. So will this alter the way we manage the effects of climate change? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I am Hashim Ahlbarra. We've been given a clear but mixed picture of the world's glaciers. The Institute of Environmental Geoscience and Dartmouth College have put together a revealing atlas. It shows glaciers hold less ice and fresh water than previously thought, so they shouldn't add as much as fear to rising sea levels. But the overall trend of warming and loss remains unchanged. South America's tropical Andes Mountains, for example, were found to have nearly a quarter less of ice. The darker colors show where glaciers are melting the fastest. Though more positive for sea levels, the research has gloomy implications for drinking water, agriculture, and power generation in places that depend on glaciers. Let's bring in our guests in Hanover, New Hampshire, Matthew Morligan, Distinguished Professor of Earth Sciences at Dartmouth College and co-author of the report. In Zurich, Professor Daniel Farinotti is Chair of Glaciology at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. In Brussels, Stefan Zinger, Senior Climate Science and Global Energy Policy Advisor at the Climate Action Network International. Welcome to the program. Matthew, the retreat of ice sheets and glaciers has been closely monitored over the last few years. This time, with the new report suggesting there's less ice in the glaciers and less fresh water, is it just consolidating the belief that this is something which is linked to global warming?
So this is a great question. First, I would like to put things maybe a bit in context. Mm-hmm. And we're talking here about mountain glaciers. So we basically have land ice that's split between the glaciers that are in mountains and the big ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica. Mm-hmm. So while this number of 20% may sound like a lot, it represents about 6 centimeters of sea level rise. Whereas one single glacier in Antarctica alone, Thwaites Glacier, that you may have heard of, sometimes referred to as Doomsday Glacier, would add 2 feet to the ocean. So in terms of sea level implications, this number is actually pretty small. The sea level is going to continue to rise, and it's rising at an increasing rate. Now, something that people may not realize is that we still know very little about the glaciers that we have in our mountains. There is 200,000 of them distributed around the globe, and it's notoriously difficult to predict their future because we still lack basic knowledge of their geometry, how big they are, how thick they are. We've had a lot of progress over the past 30, 40 years mm-hmm. with satellites in space. And so we've been using this to try to better understand how much ice we have left.
Good. Daniel, since we're trying to build together the knowledge about what is happening, is this something which is happening over the last few years, decades, or this is something that was linked to the global warming that started with the Industrial Revolution?
So you are referring to the trend that mm-hmm. glaciers are undergoing? Mm-hmm. And well, this is certainly something that has not started in the last couple of days or years. This is indeed, as you mentioned, something that has started more or less since the Industrial Revolution. So since mankind has started emitted greenhouse gases at a very elevated rate. So this has been now ongoing for 150 years or so. And if you so wish, at this stage, we are a bit paying the price of all these emissions that we have caused.
Stefan, because we will definitely go into details about this whole aspects of the report, the reason why I asked the question about the when the Earth temperature rose by 1% 1 Celsius, sorry, with the Industrial Revolution, is that you have those who would tell you that the glaciers and the ice sheets survived previous warmings. Why should we be concerned now?
Yeah, because that's nonsense, to be honest, because you have national ice ages, cycles, steered by the sun. I'm not getting into detail here. It happens every 100,000, 200,000 years. So the last ice age was 15,000 years back, where much of the globe was covered with ice. The sea level, for instance, was about 50 meters deep, 50 meters lower, et cetera, in certain parts of the globe. And then it has melted and it went into normal warming ages. So it's a complete different dynamics we are seeing here. This is caused by CO2. This is caused by global greenhouse gases. Science has identified this very, very clearly as a major driver for exponential melting. We don't have a linear melting. We have an exponential melting, right? Mm-hmm. So we're losing about, from the glaciers, and not only from the glaciers, also from Greenland and from Antarctica, where most of the sea level rise comes from, we're losing a couple of 100 billion tons of ice per year on a net base. So the amount of ice lost is much higher than the reformation of ice in those glaciers, including those glaciers which have been covered in the study, which are the terrestrial mountain glaciers. The difference between those glacier types are simple. Ice lost in Greenland or in Antarctica will get into the sea. Mm-hmm. And it's lost because it's dissolving with seawater, which is not drinkable. Mm. Whereas glaciers in the Himalayas, for instance, are one of the biggest sources for fresh water, for agriculture, for forestry, for ecosystems, for hundreds of millions of people in the highly populated areas of South Asia. Mm-hmm. If that is gone or if that is reduced, there's a problem. There's a huge problem.
Okay. Matthew, so when you think about the almost 2 billion people living and relying on water that flows from the glaciers in the Himalayan region, what's next if we cannot reverse the trend? It looks like a catastrophic scenario for this population.
Well, these communities will have to adapt to, you know, a change. They, especially during the dry season, they won't have the water coming from the glaciers helping them with agriculture, with drinking water, with power production. So they will have to rely on other sources. So our hope is that policymakers take these new numbers into account and revise how they change the way we do things today.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, in different regions of the world, we've seen what's called now the river piracy, when because of the erosion and because of the retreat of the glaciers, water and rivers are redirected in high mountains from a region to a region. Do those local populations have to readjust to this new reality? Do they have to think about new sources of water management?
I'm not sure about the new sources, in the sense that there is no water reservoirs to be discovered. Mm-hmm. So we know where the water is and how much is out there. In the study that has just been conducted by Professor Morlingham and colleagues, basically tells us better how much of that water is. So I think what the study can help with is to design policies by which this amount of water that now we know with better certainty is there, how can it be used?
Matthew, there's this report in the past that said that even if countries manage to curb greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, one third of the Himalayan glaciers will disappear. Have we hit the tipping point here?
Yeah, that's the the big elephant in the room, the tipping points. We do not know what will be the critical points when ecosystems, in this case water systems, the glacial sheets will change towards a new equilibrium. We do not know this in detail, but we have very, very strong concerns as scientists, as NGOs, that this might happen around 1.5 degrees Celsius global warming, which is considered the survival temperature threshold for most vulnerable communities, for fragile nature, for sustainable food production, for forestry, biodiversity, et cetera, et cetera. And we are not there yet. But the gap towards 1.5C is very, very narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And we might see tipping points on other areas, which might accelerate tipping points again on other ecosystems. That might be a kind of running development, which might be not very nice. We need to keep in mind, it's a carbon legacy in our atmosphere. We currently have a carbon concentration, a CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, but it's probably the highest since between 8 and 10 million years, what we know from paleontologists.
Mm-hmm.
Mankind was not there. Homo sapiens came on Earth only 600,000 years ago. And it takes time. There's a time lag also until the carbon legacy, the carbon in the atmosphere, which lasts very long, up to 1,000 years, will develop, unfold its effect on global warming and its effect on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So even if we reduce emissions significantly now, even if we reduce it significantly now, we still see growing, though not as strong as now, warming. And we might even exceed 1.5C. But then afterwards, we go down significantly to meet the survival target of 1.5C, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
But we lost 40 years.
Okay. Matthew, since we're trying to get a sense of what is exactly happening, so we're talking about two different aspects here, the ice sheets and the potential impact on the sea level and the glaciers on the mountains and the potential for massive impact on local populations in terms of access to fresh water, energy, and so on and so forth. Now, I would like to ask you this question, particularly about the ice sheets. How is it melting and under what pace? Are we talking about the ice sheet on top of the landmass or just the one which is on the very edges embracing the oceans?
So the overall ice sheets, both Greenland and Antarctica, are losing mass and it's widespread. It's not just where it's meeting the ocean, it's also upstream. And we've been looking at this for the past 3-4 decades using different instruments, using satellites. And we know that the triggering mechanism in Antarctica is the ocean. So we have warmer currents that are at depth, at 300, 400 meters below the surface, that used to stay away from the ice sheet. And with climate change, with changes in wind patterns, this water is now making its way and melting the ice, the floating ice from below. And that has implications in terms of dynamics, in terms of how much icebergs fall into the ocean every year. Now, this is for Antarctica. For Greenland, half of the mass loss is due to a warming of the ocean. And half of the mass loss is just due to the fact that we have longer summers, we have a longer melt season. So we have also more snow that's now become falling in the form of rain. So we have less ice coming into Greenland every year. So overall, they're both losing a lot of mass, and this mass loss is increasing year after year. To follow up maybe on Stefan's point, I completely agree with what he said. I think it's we're watching here a disaster in slow motion, and the glaciers are going to continue to melt. Now, we still have control on future rates of mass loss. Yes, they're going to, you know, slowly continue to disappear, but we still have control on how much we can try to preserve in the future.
Daniel, what does it mean when the glaciers recede? What kind of impact does it have on the climate, on the Earth itself, before we go into details about its impact on the human population?
Well, first to the impact on climate, it is indeed a fact that glaciers and glacier retreat, and especially ice sheet retreat, can have an impact itself on climate change. And the way you need to picture this is that the glaciers are white, so glacier and snow are white, and so they're able to reflect back to space a significant portion of the radiation that we get from the sun. So if you remove the glaciers because they melt, the surface will give rise to a much darker surface, because instead of ice, you will have rocks or whatever comes underneath them. And this will absorb more of this energy that we get from the sun, thus increasing the temperature locally. And by increased temperature, you will melt more glaciers, so you will retreat the glacier even more, and this ends up being a feedback. So this is important for glaciers, but it is very important also for other part of what we call the cryosphere. So for example, sea ice. So sea ice is the ice that you form on top of oceans during winter. And this is exactly the same. So they're white, they reflect a lot of sunlight. And if you start shrinking that, you will absorb more heat and so make everything warmer.
Stefan, is this an indication that we're likely to see more severe storms, floods, long cycles of drought in the near future?
I fully believe that this will happen, unfortunately. I mean, we're getting next week in the start of a new round of the scientists discussing a new international science report from the IPCC, which looks into impacts, vulnerability, and adaptation. And a major part of that report, which will come out in 2 weeks, is it's a long approval process, which will come out, will look into the impacts of enhanced melting, of enhanced sea level rise, and it will look also into so-called soft limits to adaptation and hard limits to adaptation. I cannot tell you much about this because the report has not been agreed here, but the point is the IPCC, the scientists, make very clear certain limits to adaptation might be shifting over time because mankind develops technologies and adaptation is possible, but there are also hard limits, really hard limits, not only to temperature change, but also to sea level rise. We talk about sea level rise here, and to melting. Melting is happening currently exponentially. Sea level rise is happening exponentially. Mm-hmm. And we know from the science, on the physical science, that all the projections also by the IPCC, which had been given in the last years, might be all too low. There might be. I'm not looking in the big crystal ball here, but there might be the risk that sea level rise might have much faster when we go over 2 meters by 2100, which is much higher than is projected even under worst case scenarios. That might happen, and the IPCC is looking into that one. What that means, what does it mean for adaptation needs for people who live in coastal areas, in low-lying island states, in cities? We have about the majority of people will live in 2050 in cities which are related to coastal areas to sea level, mm-hmm. which is pretty low. And that's the majority of people will be living.
Yeah. Matthew,
that's a challenge we're facing.
Sure. Matthew, when you look at those grim details about the glaciers and the ice sheets, what is there anything that we can do to reverse the trend?
The best thing we can do is reduce our carbon emissions. I think it's the triggering mechanism. Whatever you look at, warming, melting of the ice sheets, shrinking of sea ice in the Arctic, ocean acidification, all of this comes back to carbon emissions and how much carbon we have in the atmosphere. So the sooner, the faster we reduce our emissions in the atmosphere, the better we'll be.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, so if you have the risk of many, many cities all over the world which risk to be submerged because they are coastal areas, and then you have the glaciers which are receding, glaciers feed rivers, which irrigate crops, which feed human beings, all over the world, we're talking about an Armageddon here where only if the world comes together with the most powerful industrial nations coming together to solve it, we're just doomed in a way or another. Daniel?
Yeah, I would basically agree to what you said. So we are facing a challenge that is far beyond being solvable for individual actors and not individual nations. So as Matthew correctly said, it boils down to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And this has to do with the way we produce matter, so materials, so how our industry works. It has to do with the way we heat our houses and generate kind of thermal energy for whatever we need it for. It has to do in the way we are using land surfaces, so how much emissions we cause from there. It has to do with the way we nourish ourselves, so what kind of mm-hmm. food we have. And finally, it has to do with the way we're generating energy for whatever we do, being it moving around, okay. lighting our houses, etc. And this, we agree, is something that cannot be solved by individual persons. It's indeed kind of a global undertaking.
Stefan, you have those skeptics who would say that, you see, the problem with you scientists is that you use climate modelling and you use data comparisons to bring about those grim reminders about a doomsday when, in fact, the Earth had its own way of regenerating and that one day, you know what, we'll get a new cold cycle, the ice sheets will be refurbished, the glaciers will be refurbished, there will be more snow covering the Earth and life will start fresh again.
Well, eventually, if we manage to phase out fossil fuels pretty soon, because CO2 is a main greenhouse gas, which causes the main damage in the atmosphere for global warming, at some point in time, the ice might come fully back. Mm-hmm. That's why we need, at the meantime, strong adaptation as well. Mm-hmm. But we need also loss and damage. We need to basically compensate those poor environmental defenders and communities who are directly affected. And mostly those are poor communities which don't have the resilience, which don't have the resources to defend themselves close to the sea. You said before cities might be submerged. Before cities are being submerged, if you look at cities in developing countries, most settlements are close to the sea. They're small villages. People live in huts, have no air conditioning, have hardly electricity. Those are, subsidiary existences. They will be the first to be flushed away. It will first hit the poor. The poor in developing countries, which are close to the sea, living in those cities. The rich countries, we can adapt in one way or the other. We might be able to move to another house, to another flat higher mm-hmm. up in the mountains or so on. The poor cannot do that. Mm-hmm. They don't have the means to do that. That's a human tragedy we are facing. And to say, oh, it will all come back, the ice will come back. By that time, we have lost millions of people probably.
Okay.
We have lost food security. We have lost biodiversity. I think that's very important to keep in mind. It's a time factor. We deal with issues which are short time, mm-hmm. very short time. In geological spheres. In geological spheres, long term, yes, it might all come back.
Okay.
Biodiversity will not come back.
Against the backdrop of what we've been talking about, Matthew, do you think that renewable energy technology could be a key to some of the problems that we are facing? We're talking about they have the potential to produce cleaner energy and move us away from the fossil fuel.
Oh, I do think so. I think it's part of the solution. I think, you know, we always say we didn't get out of Stone Age because we ran out of stones. It's a bit the same idea here. Our entire economies are based on fossil fuel, and greener energies, new technologies are helping shifting this towards something that's more sustainable. So part of the solution will be developing new technologies that are less, that requires less energy or, run on electricity instead of gas. But we also have to think about how much we as individuals consume in terms of energy, in terms of food. And, you know, if everybody wants an iPhone, a car, wants to eat meat twice a day, there will be a cost associated to this. And we have to look at every possible options here to try to reduce as much as we can the emission of carbon into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. The ice volume, Daniel, now, when we're talking about glaciers, If it continues retreating with the same pace that we're talking about now, could it trigger an environmental imbalance that could be catastrophically severe?
I'm not entirely sure to understand the question, mm-hmm. but if you're asking whether something catastrophic could help at this by continuing ice melt at this rate, I must refer back to something that was said by Stefan earlier. And the problem is not that the ice rate happens and then something catastrophic mm-hmm. happens. The problem is that the ice melting is kind of exponentially increasing. And especially that the system, so climate system, has some point that are what we call nonlinear. So say, if you have warmed the Earth by 1 degree, and now you're at another degree, it doesn't mean that you will see the same effect as in the first degree you saw. The effect of the second degree may be very, very different. And this is basically what those tipping points are about. So we are approaching, we think that in many sectors of our climate system and our kind of Earth system as a whole, we're reaching those points that, we cannot come back from them, or at least not in human relevant timescales.
Stefan Zinger, Daniel Farinotti, Matthew Mulligan, thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate your insight. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Hashim Ahbara, and the entire team here in Doha. Bye for now.